Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. And from Florida State University, a preeminent institution. FSU license plates support scholarships for deserving students who enrich and contribute to our community, the state, and nation. More at fsu.edu/mytag. WFSU FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
In the wake of last week's mass school shooting, Florida's governor and leading lawmakers unveiled their gun safety proposals.
It's not like there's one silver bullet that fixes everything. But I think the more law enforcement, the sharing of information, the more mental health, the hardening, all these things together, my goal is to make our schools safe.
Also tonight, the past 9 days has sparked plenty of debate on gun laws, but what about the larger conversation that's now underway?
And so it's not really a question for me of what's the solution. It's a question of what is the law of this country.
True criminal copycats or youngsters being clueless? We'll also learn how law enforcers are dealing with some fine distinctions when it comes to verbal versus written threats. And we'll get an update on the South Florida students who went face-to-face with Tallahassee lawmakers. 2 weeks to go in the 2018 Florida lawmaking session. I'm Tom Flanagan. This is Capitol Report. Governor Rick Scott, as well as the Florida House and Senate leadership, have unveiled their gun safety proposals in response to last week's mass school shooting. As Sasha Cordner reports, they include some differences and some similarities.
Governor Scott's gun safety proposal has several key points. For example, an at-risk person who has a mental illness who was involuntarily committed must surrender all firearms and must wait 60 days before petitioning a court to regain that right. It also raises the age for a person to buy a gun.
We will require all individuals purchasing firearms to be 21 or older. There will be exceptions for active duty and reserve military and spouses, National Guard members, and law enforcement. Next, we will prohibit a person from possessing or purchasing a firearm if they are subject to an injunction for protection against stalking, cyber stalking, dating violence, repeat violence, sexual violence, or domestic violence.
Given what's been going on around the state where kids have been threatening schools via social media, Scott's plan hopes to address that. And he wants a bump stock ban as well. Used in past mass shootings, bump stocks are add-ons that can allow a semi-automatic weapon to fire like an automatic weapon with the pull of a single trigger.
We will establish enhanced criminal penalties for threats to schools, like social media threats of shootings or bombings. We'll also enhance penalties if any person possesses or purchases a gun after they have been deemed by state law to not have access to a gun. And we will completely ban the purchase or sale of bump stocks.
Scott's plan also calls for metal detectors, bulletproof glass, and steel doors. Similar to the Florida legislature, Scott's proposal includes about $500 million toward mental health funding initiatives and aims to enhance school safety.
Today, I'm calling for a mandatory law enforcement officer in every public school. These law enforcement officers must either be sworn sheriff's deputies or police officers and being present during all hours students are on campus. The size of the campus should be a factor in determining staff levels by the county sheriff's office. And I am proposing at least one law enforcement officer for every 1,000 students. This must be implemented by the start of the 2018 school year.
But one main area of difference between lawmakers and the governor is arming teachers. Governor Scott says he's against it.
I disagree with arming the teachers. My focus is on bringing in law enforcement. I think you need to have individuals that are trained, well-trained.
But House Speaker Richard Corcoran says the House and Senate proposal will include a provision that allows certain teachers to carry firearms on school grounds.
What it includes is the most robust, first of its kind of any of the 50 states system where we say if you are a licensed law enforcement officer who has been trained and has the credential hours to be a law enforcement officer and you're a certified teacher, yes, that person who's duly hired as a teacher from the superintendent, as a law enforcement officer from the sheriff, yes, they can carry guns as a school resource officer can in the school system. It's the first of its kind, and it is the absolutely, in my opinion, the game changer in this legislation.
Still, some gun control advocates say enhancing background checks and an assault weapons ban needs to happen. But Senate President Joe Negron says when it comes to the ban, they can only do what's allowed in law.
I think that there's a delicate balance, and even in difficult times, we have to follow the Constitution. We have to show fidelity to the Constitution. It's my view that a proposal that would have outlawed a particular type of weapon would fall into the area of being an unconstitutional taking from law-abiding citizens and wouldn't directly address the underlying causes.
But Orlando Democratic Representative Carlos Guillermo Smith is not buying it, citing a court case.
After 21 first graders were murdered in their first grade classroom, the Connecticut legislature stepped up and they banned assault weapons. Who sued? Well, the gun lobby sued. Of course they did. Of course they dragged them to court. Every single court that took up that case upheld the constitutionality of an assault weapons ban. So this idea that we are violating the Second Amendment by making sure that everyday civilians don't have access to weapons of mass destruction, which is what military-style assault weapons are, is absurd. This is what people are demanding.
Still, in the Connecticut case, the High Court did say the AR-15 is protected under the Second Amendment. Meanwhile, according to the agenda calendar, the Senate could soon take up its gun safety proposals as soon as Monday. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
The tragic Parkland shooting is just the most recent driver of the long-running debate on gun control in this country. The spectrum of opinions can create either a stalemate or compromise, but at the moment, a conversation is being had, as we hear from Andrew Quintana.
Brandon Wolf is a survivor of the 2016 Pulse nightclub shooting in Orlando. It is a battle he says he has been fighting ever since his experience. He has been pushing for greater gun regulations alongside the surviving students of the Parkland shooting.
I felt hopeless. And over the next few months, I realized that my hopelessness might be well-founded because at every turn, someone shushed me. Someone told me to sit down and be quiet. Someone told me it wasn't the right time to talk about what I went through. And when I saw on Valentine's Day that there had been another shooting, and again, this time it was children, I felt that same sense of hopelessness.
The recent tragedy has sparked debate over gun laws, and, as Wolf says, it's finally created movement in Florida's legislature.
In 10 years, we haven't gotten movement on this issue. And all it took was a group of angry children with the right message to slap some sense into somebody.
Wolf, along with many gun control advocates, wants stricter regulations on firearms. This is why anti-gun advocates are pushing for bans on high-capacity magazine weapons, or assault rifles. Andy Pelosi is the co-chair of Florida Coalition to Prevent Gun Violence. He says one specific gun, the semi-automatic rifle, is the cause of many mass shootings.
Since 1980, there have been at least 60 mass shootings in the U.S., and the mass shooting we're defining as three or more fatalities, where the shooter used a high-capacity magazine, a magazine holding at least 10 rounds or more. Over 600 people were killed and over 1,000 were injured.
Eric Friday is the general counsel for Florida Carry, a gun rights group. He argues the issue is a matter of policy.
It doesn't matter if there's a majority of the people that want more gun control. We're dealing with a fundamental right.
He says there is no clear definition of assault rifles. Many bans on assault rifles focus on cosmetic aspects and not fire rate. Friday says no matter what either side pushes for, there is no changing a constitutional right.
People have a liberty interest in having such things, in having certain firearms that they want to own.
He mentions the Supreme Court case of Heller and McDonald as the precedent gun owners follow when purchasing weapons.
The Supreme Court has said that the Second Amendment protects arms that citizens can use in the defense of themselves or in the service of the militia that are in common use by the populace.
Common use means the most popular weapon amongst gun owners, which can range from a stun gun or an AR-15. According to Friday, it does not include specific military weapons.
Military weapons are selective fire. meaning they have the option to fire semi-automatic or full automatic or a certain number of round burst. And those are already banned in the U.S. unless they were manufactured before 1986, and they cost about $20,000 a piece or more.
The AR-15 was created for the military in the 1950s. It became available to the public in the early 1960s. But as to the question of whether semi-automatics can be banned, Connecticut did so in 2013 after the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting. The law was challenged, but courts have so far upheld it. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Andrew Quintana.
Still to come on Capitol Report, Florida's school shooting tragedy has the state's law enforcers super sensitized to possible copycat criminals. But how can they tell legitimate threats from simple youthful stupidity?
Some people think every type of threat would be criminal. The fact is that that's not necessarily true.
And we'll find out how the students of Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School are struggling to reclaim their lives.
Students that I've talked to, they're pretty adamant about getting back to school and reclaiming Marjory Stoneman Douglas.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by the Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org.
There have been nearly 100 threats leveled against schools in the wake of the Valentine's Day shooting at the South Florida High School. Many of the potential copycats are teens and students themselves. Some have claimed they were just joking. Law enforcement officials say they take all threats seriously, and many students have been arrested for them. Some are facing felony charges, which carry sentences of up to 15 years. But whether those charges will stick is another matter. And state prosecutors say there's no law in the books directly addressing threats against schools. And the ones that are in place for general threats of violence are in need of updates. Lynn Hatter spoke with Second Judicial Circuit State Attorney Jack Campbell, who says when deciding whether to bring charges, it comes down to one question: was the threat explicit or implicit?
This comes down to a matter versus an explicit versus an implicit threat. So some of what we've seen students saying, especially on social media, is things like "you're going to be next" or "don't come to school today." And those would fall into what you were describing earlier as implicit threats.
I mean, obviously, I think anybody in their right mind would be intimidated, particularly in today's society with what we've seen. I'm a parent. I'm a member of this community. That scares me. That's obviously drawing emotional responses. But the laws as they are currently written in state statute don't allow us to criminally charge people based purely on that kind of language as you listed.
Now, one of the things that there is language in law, right, that does apply to, I believe, written threats and language that applies to oral threats. Can you explain that?
Sure. There's a specific statute, and it's been on the books for a long time, that says that if I write communicate a written threat to you, threaten death or great bodily harm to you. It's Florida Statute 836.10 holds that it's a second-degree felony punishable by 15 years in prison for me to threaten you. So if I were to write you a letter or communicate, and they actually amended it to allow for electronic, so if I emailed you a message saying that I'm going to kill Renelle Gones or any other reporter that you worked with, then that would be against the law. However, me just saying words to the effect that kind of lead that, but not making an express threat and not communicating it to a victim, just putting out there that I'm dangerous and I'm going to do bad things, that does not fall into that law.
So the problem is really that the law, well, part of the problem is that the law hasn't necessarily kept up with the times, because so many of these things are occurring on Facebook, Twitter, Snapchat, and under the written law, it would have to be, what, a formal letter or something like that?
It can be. Well, they did amend it in 2010 to allow electronic communication, so email does allow that, but what it doesn't, I mean, I think this does predate social media, but that's where I get into the difference between an express and an implicit. You know, if you take a picture of, as we keep on seeing, these folks with, you know, lots of guns or pictures in front, even express things saying, like, don't go to school next week. That does not rise to the level that allows criminal prosecution. It actually requires more than that. It once again requires that I expressly tell you or somebody who cares about you, I'm planning on hurting or killing you. And that doesn't raise to the level. I mean, you have, we're trying to look at lots of different statutes to try to figure out how it works, but the explicit one, and they're trying to fix it, it's currently in front of the legislature, is 836.10, which holds that any person who writes or composes and also sends or procures the sending of any letter, inscribed communication, or electronics communication, whether such letter or communication be signed or anonymous, to any person containing a threat to kill or do bodily injury to the person to whom such letter or communication is sent, or to threaten or to kill or do bodily injury to any member of the family of the person to whom such letter or communication is sent, commits a felony of the second degree. So I could actually tell you or send you a letter saying I was going to hurt somebody who's not related to you, and that, once again, would not fall under that statute. So with social media, you can throw things into the air, and certainly it's going to find its way home to people who are scared, but the way the laws are currently drafted, we can't take any criminal charges and do anything about it.
So what's going to happen to these children? Some of them, again, are facing charges, but you did note the difficulty in taking these things to trial.
Well, and it's not just a trial problem. I can't, just because I'm going to lose a trial isn't the issue. I cannot file a charge that's not supported by the law, ethically speaking. So what's going to happen on each of these cases is, you know, law enforcement is going to continue to investigate them and take whatever action they deem appropriate, and they're going to bring us those cases. We're going to look at it, and if there's any way for us to charge them under current law, we will do so. If we're not, if there's no law that makes what they did illegal, then we're going to drop the charges and move on. For some people think that every type of threat would be criminal. The fact is that that's not necessarily true.
That's Florida's 2nd Judicial Circuit State Attorney Jack Campbell speaking with Florida Public Radio's Lynn Hatter. With a quick overview of other legislative happenings this week at the Capitol, here's Bob Brooks from our sister operation, the Florida Channel.
While the school shooting in Parkland has occupied much of Tallahassee's attention this week, there were also other issues addressed in the legislature. The House called attention to the public risk created by pornography with House Bill 57. A committee substitute for that bill acknowledged the need for additional education, prevention, research, and policy changes to protect Florida's citizens, and it was adopted by the House. The House also passed HB 703, which makes changes to how surplus lands are sold and mandates that funds from those sales are to be used by the state to buy necessary property. Committee substitutes for House Bills 85 and 87 were passed by the Senate. These bills authorize the Department of State to cooperate with a non-governmental organization to verify voter registration information and to make sure that information received from other states is exempt from Florida's public records request. Both bills had already passed the House, and both now await the governor's signature before becoming law. The Division of the State Fire Marshal will have to provide training for firefighters relating to cancer and mental health risks if House Bill 309 and Senate Bill 394 pass their respective chambers. Next week, each chamber is slated to consider more than 100 bills. As those bills have worked their way through the numerous committees, they've been analyzed, critiqued, debated, they've had language amended to and deleted from, and they've been voted on. Some have passed, but not all have survived, and not all will survive being debated on the floor. We may also see some new bills arise. And there's the budget. From the Florida Channel, I'm Bob Brooks for Florida Public Radio.
Well, if you remember last year, Governor Rick Scott was bragging that the Trump administration had agreed to steer $1.5 billion in supplemental Medicaid funding to the state, saying at the time the money would, in his words, truly improve the quality and access to health care for our most vulnerable populations. But the amount of Medicaid money that will flow to the low-income pool program this year is a lot less, somewhere in the neighborhood of $730 million. That's less than half of the potential amount and about $60 million less than what Medicaid Director Ben Kidder told lawmakers last fall would be available for the state to spend. Nevertheless, Agency for Healthcare Administration Secretary Justin Senior was still optimistic this week. He was predicting the state will tap into the full $1.5 billion in supplemental Medicaid dollars at some point. The low-income pool, which provides additional funds to hospitals that serve large numbers of poor and uninsured patients, is comprised of money from Florida and the federal government. But Florida doesn't use state tax dollars for its required match. Instead, the state calls on local governments and local health care taxing districts to provide the cash to fund the program. You're listening to Capital Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School teachers had the option of going back to school today for the first time since last week's shooting that left 17 people dead and more than a dozen others injured. Students return on Wednesday. From member station WLRN in Miami, Jessica Bakeman reports some people are afraid to go back to school and others desperately want to get back to some routine. We do want to let you know in this story there are some descriptions of what happened that are hard to listen to.
On the day after the nation's deadliest high school shooting, Stoneman Douglas freshman Melanie Lee and her mom Heather went to Pine Trails Park in Parkland for a vigil honoring the 17 victims. Melanie said she was in shock.
Everything's going to be different. It can't go back to the way it used to be.
Her mom didn't know when school would reopen and what she would do when it did.
I'm not sure that she's going to go back. I honestly think it'll be too hard for her and for me to worry about if she's going to come home.
Have you thought about other options?
Probably homeschool. Yeah. Keep her at home. Three of her classmates died, and she, by the grace of God, had angels around her that day. She was sitting right next to two of them, and somehow the bullets missed her.
Melanie was hiding under a desk, holding her teacher's hand, when she saw one of her classmates die.
It didn't look real. I didn't think it was real.
I checked back in with the Lees a week later. Heather says she's leaving it up to her daughter as to whether she'll go back. Melanie wants to try. First, the teachers go back. Then there's an orientation for students on Sunday. And school starts again on Wednesday. Melanie's going to see how she feels after the orientation. If not, plan B, Mom says, homeschool.
If there is a student that absolutely does not want to return to the school, we are going to work with them to pursue other options in the district.
Robert Runcie is Broward County School Superintendent. He said when school reopens, mental health services will be available and enhanced security.
Students that I've talked to, they're pretty adamant about getting back to school and reclaiming Marjory Stoneman Douglas.
When the shooter opened fire on his classmates and teachers, most of the horror took place in Building 12, which students call the freshman building. They won't have to go back there. The whole schedule has been reworked to fit all the students and teachers in other buildings on campus.
It's going to be tight, but they've come up with some good creative ways to keep all of the students together.
But of course, the whole campus is a hard place to be for people who lived through the shooting.
I have students who don't want to go back in the classroom where they were held, don't want to go back in the closet where they were hiding, don't want to be in the auditorium because they were hiding in there.
Sarah Lerner teaches English and journalism and is the yearbook advisor at Stoneman Douglas. One of the victims, Jamie Guttenberg, was in her introductory journalism class this year, and she had taught another, Meadow Pollock, in freshman English.
It's a sensory thing. Some of them just don't want to hear the fire alarm or the school bell or, you know, anything that might trigger memories and feelings from last Wednesday.
She's been trying to take care of herself, talking to a counselor, drinking water, taking naps, so she can be healthy enough to care for her students and her own family. Her oldest child goes to the middle school next door to Stoneman Douglas. Lerner has been hearing from her students, getting text messages and calls and emails, sometimes in the middle of the night. On February 14th, She had senior English last period.
And I was giving them a quiz.
On George Orwell's 1984.
You know, I had joked that I was going to, you know, ruin their Valentine's Day. And as they were taking their quiz, I was putting little Hershey kisses on their desks. You know, here's a kiss while you take your quiz.
The fire alarm went off. She and her students started to leave, then turned back when they realized it was a code red. Some of them scattered. Lerner locked herself and 15 students in her classroom so they could hide. She has mixed feelings about being called back to work.
I don't know that I'm ready to physically step foot on campus, but I know that doing that is part of the healing process. And, you know, I want to start to get as back to normal as we can.
It's hard to imagine anything like normal now. Some of the kids who survived the shooting quickly became national celebrities, prominent voices for gun control. They met with lawmakers in Tallahassee, with the president in Washington, and interviewed U.S. Senators Marco Rubio and Bill Nelson during a live CNN broadcast from the BB&T Center in Sunrise. This is audio of Stoneman Douglas Jr. Cameron Caskey from when he was on CNN.
Senator Rubio, can you tell me right now that you will not accept a single donation from the NRA in the future?
Some students have said into the TV cameras that they won't go back to school until there's change. But privately, they worry about falling behind. One told me he's got 5 AP classes this year and is supposed to take the SAT next month. Another has the lead role in a musical. Senior David Hogg is one of the most visible student activists. He's been targeted by far-right conspiracy theorists, accusing him of being a so-called crisis actor brought in by media organizations to perform a certain political point of view.
I don't know when or if or how I'll be able to go back to school. I just know that I have to.
This is Hogg during a gun control rally in Fort Lauderdale a few days after the shooting.
That's what these people want. They want us to be afraid, and I'm not going to accept that.
At the same rally, a brother and sister who go to Stoneman Douglas also felt determined to return. Senior Diego Pfeiffer, perhaps a bit more than Isabella, a junior. Diego said he was in a closet with more than 60 people when the shooting took place.
There was one person next to me who was bawling, and she said, I don't want to go to school anymore. What I told her in the closet was, you've lived 17, 18 years already. You can't let 2 hours take away all the great memories that we had at our school. Of course, I feel scared. And of course, there's nothing that could ever like make me feel completely safe again. But I want to go back, and I want to make more good memories at Douglas.
Isabella said she's terrified to go back. But she feels like her classmates and teachers there are the only ones in the world who can understand what she's going through.
It's like a home, but that's kind of been torn down, if that makes any sense at all.
Her brother nodded and reassured her. It's still our home. I'm Jessica Bakeman in Parkland.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Lynn Hatter, and Regan McCarthy. We also thank Andrew Quintana, Jessica Bakeman, and our sister operation, the Florida Channel. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report, and join us each weeknight at this time throughout the 2018 Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at wfsu.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. And from Florida State University, a preeminent institution. FSU license plates support scholarships for deserving students who enrich and contribute to our community, the state, and nation. More at fsu.edu/mytag. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.